Suppose you're applying for a job. You'd probably hope there's a real person on the other end, someone actually reading your application and judging you fairly. Or think about applying for a loan at your bank. In reality, many companies and banks may employ AI in these situations in the near future to help make those decisions. That raises an important question. Can we rely on AI to make fair judgments? And taking that a step further, we might ask something even deeper. If AI learns from the world as it is, and the world itself isn't particularly fair, what does that mean for the decisions AI makes? And if bias is baked into the data, how, if at all, can we fix it? That's what I want to explore today with my guest, Tejumada Afonja. Let's go. Hi, and welcome back to CISPA TLDR, the podcast of the CISPA Helmholtz Center for Information Security, where we talk about cybersecurity and AI without all the buzzwords. I sit down with the researchers behind the work to get clear explanations and make sense of what they're doing. I'm Tobias Ebelshäuser from CISPA's communications team, and trust me, I'm not a computer scientist either, so I'm learning right along with you. Today, we're going to talk about what I think is one of the most pressing questions in AI research. How fair are our AI systems? As these systems are increasingly used in situations that directly affect our everyday lives, this is something that deserves a closer look. But to understand whether AI can be fair, we need to understand not only the technology itself, but also the world it learns from. That's why I invited Tejumada Afonja, who joined CISPA in 2022 as a PhD student and conducts research on privacy and security aspects of machine learning and AI. Hi, Tejumada. Great to have you with us today.
Hi, Tobias. Thank you for having me.
So, Teju, before we get technical, I want to learn a bit about you. You started out in engineering. How did you end up working in AI at the end?
That's a great question. Okay. So, I started out as a mechanical engineer. I did my bachelor's back in Nigeria, Ladoke Akintola University of Technology. And I remember that sometimes during my second year, I got fascinated about machines that can think from some IEEE meeting. And since then, I started to think about thinking machines. But because I was studying mechanical engineering, we didn't really have curriculum that support programming or being able to explore this. So during my final year, I managed to convince my supervisor that I should work on robot.
Okay.
So I had a team, a small team, where we investigated robot vacuum cleaner. And I started to learn about robotics, and because this is my idea of machines that can think, that roams around and are intelligent, that does something. Mm-hmm. So this is also how I got into programming a little bit. And so AI is for me, it was more like as a way to understand this intelligent part of the machines that can think, because I already have a mechanical engineering background. I could build the parts. This is why I thought I needed to learn the intelligent part. And so this led me to go into machine learning, and the journey just continued from there.
Okay.
And now I am here. I did my master's in computer science, so now I know a lot more about these thinking machines, but a lot less about how to make them roam about. Because I kind of along the journey, I'm no longer a roboticist.
You just dropped
into machine learning.
Part.
Yeah.
So you took the learning from machine.
Yeah, I know, but you never can tell how it's all gonna add up.
Yeah.
I always imagine I'm gonna have my own garage where I'm making robots.
Like Tony Stark in the cave.
Exactly. Anyway.
Yeah, awesome. Was there something particular that fascinated you about that, as you said, the intelligent part of the machine, like that AI part?
Yeah, I think it's just this autonomy, I would say. So the particular machine that actually made me so interested was this NASA Curiosity rover.
Mm-hmm.
That was when it was in Mars.
Yeah.
And there was something about looking at that image and it felt like you can sense something very far away. No human is there.
Yeah.
And it's gathering data. It's collecting things by itself. I don't know, for a 15, 16-year-old girl, it just felt like the future.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be part of that future. So I think that was where my fascination, where it started. That was that spark. And I started to learn a bit more about it. And I wanted to build machines that are useful, like just to make life better, automate things and like the boring stuff and things like that. And I think even till now, this is some of the reasons why I get very excited about AI and machine learning and things like that. But at some point in my excitement and investigation, I started to find that there are good and bad sides to AI. So I started questioning a lot of things and I was thinking about privacy a lot and what happened with your data and so on. So this led me to the privacy AI research.
Okay. Awesome. I think that's already a great segue because as I've already said, I want to start like discussing this pretty big question today, almost philosophical probably. I can say if I've learned like one thing in my time at CISPA about AI models, about machine learning in general, that a model is only as good as the data it is being fed and is being trained on. But if the world behind that data that a model is being trained on isn't fair, like how much fairness can we realistically expect from AI today? I think that is like the bigger question I want to discuss with you today. But we're going to untangle this bit by bit. So let's set the stage with your latest paper where you have looked into loan approvals in Ghana, Germany, and the US. Let's start in the beginning. What motivated you to look specifically at loan approvals as a use case for AI fairness?
So loan approval is a very important application because it has a direct impact on people. And, you know, whether or not you are granted a loan has not just impact on you as a person, but on what you want to use that loan for.
Yeah.
It could be that you want to use it to start your business or you want to use it to pay your child's school fees or so on. So we thought that we would like to understand how this cutting edge models are able to like perform in that particular scenario.
Okay. So in simple terms, what does your paper look at and what question were you trying to answer with it?
Okay. So our paper looks at whether or not large language model like ChatGPT, Gemini, and so on are able to approve or deny a loan.
Okay.
And so we structure the research in form of questions. First, like benchmarking the state of the art language model on different geographically situated data set, like in Germany or in the United States. And the reason why we looked at this different data set is because we thought that loan approval is relevant geographically, so like the kind of the kind of features that you look at when you're trying to approve or deny a loan in Germany might look different from that in Ghana.
So
for example, like say in Germany, a lot of the people have higher education or like they like maybe features like have been divorced or not is relevant for some reason for loan approval.
What
then,
kind of assets they already have.
Exactly, what kind of asset they have. Yeah. And in an environment like, say for example, Ghana, one of the data sets we studied could be like how long have they been situated in that environment?
Yeah.
How connected are they with with the community and things like that. So this is why like we also look at all of this like different data set. Mm-hmm. And also it's partly also due to what data set do we have available for us. And then, yeah, so in the way we did it, we took this structured tabular data set and we serialized this tabular data set. And we, like, you know, we did this zero shot prompting of LLM. Zero shot just meaning that we just give it some instruction. So just pretend as if you are a loan officer.
Yeah.
And like these are the features that I have. Like, will you give this person a loan or not? And these features could be that, oh, this person is a female, they have three children, they never went to school, but they make this much money. Mm-hmm. Would you, are they a good person to give a loan to? Will they repay you? And LLM would come with an answer to say, oh, yes or no, based on the features that you give it to it. And a lot of work have shown that these models are biased in the sense that sometimes they use the features that you don't expect them to use, like they use the gender or they use the age to discriminate. And it's not because they want to use it. I think this comes back to the question about the data.
Yeah,
it's because historically some of this some of these features have been which we call the sensitive attribute. And so some of the sensitive attributes has been historically used by maybe some loan officer to make this decision, and so the model just encodes it as well.
Like,
and
using a name to infer ethnicity.
But like, I mean, in this case, most of the time the data set don't come with the name, but it comes with other kind of features that are useful for maybe some model to make decision, like the machine learning model. Maybe it's important for you to understand that this person is a female, and because there are certain attributes that links female to being able to repay for some reason.
Okay.
What fairness research tries to go into is that you don't want to a group of people, say for example, male, female, non-binary, whatever anyone identify as, to be discriminated against just because of their identity. So if I am giving this male a loan, it should be because of the features
that actually matters
for that decision.
Exactly. Decision,
Can, like, can they be, what are the information do you have about them? Not because they male. So those are some of the things we were trying to look at in that work, but majorly just for us to understand if LLM is able to reliably make this decision to be able to repay the loan, or they just perpetuates the existing bias in the data or society.
Okay. And maybe to dive just very shortly into that more technical level, you talked about serialization of tabular data. So it basically means you get a table, like a spreadsheet, where a lot of info is, and you can't feed that into the LLM. So you have to serialize it. Maybe how does that work, and why is it important for this study?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because so a lot of the structured tabular data, you know, you have rows and column, and each column you could have, say, numbers, age is 10, 20, and so on.
Yeah.
Or you could have categories, sex, female, male. So, but the way the large language model is trained is it's on natural text. It's very unstructured. My name is Tejumade Afonja. I am Nigerian, and so on, strings of text. But the data set that you have is tabular, right? It's structured, but you cannot just feed that into the LLM in that way. So you need to be able to find a way to make it look like the strings of text that the LLM expects. And there are multiple ways you can think about doing that. You could think, what if you take the column name, which may be the feature age, and then you just concatenate some columns, the age column and the value. Okay. So it would be like, we call it like key column value. That is one way in which you can think about serializing it to make it look like strings. And then you just concatenate all of the column and the value, and then each rows will become what you feed into the LLM to make that prediction. So there are other ways in which you can think about some people have thought about making it look like a natural language. So they would say things like column name is value. So age is 30.
Okay.
Sex is female. So we call that like natural text-like kind of serialization. And the reason all of this is important is that we've some work have found that the way you actually serialize your table matters in how the model makes its prediction.
Okay.
So like based on that, there's nothing that says that like you kind of just choose one out of the box and say, this is how I'm going to serialize. So we thought that is really important for us to benchmark, to understand for this data set, what kind of serialization is much more suited. And is there like a universal way in which you can serialize that is good for all the models, for all the data set and things like that? And our conclusion from that research or our finding is that it's actually very dependent on the model and the data set, which is, it's not too surprising because like the way the models are trained are different and different kind of decisions are made. Maybe when they were collecting all of the data, it was just like a pool of say HTML format and all of the table are in like HTML format and this is how they trained it. And so if we were doing this kind of investigation where you give some features to the LLM and you ask it to make the prediction, if it sees it in the way that is similar to how it saw it in during pre-training, then it's more likely to give an answer that is closer to what you expect than if you give it something way different.
Okay, so just to reiterate for me, so like I am applying for a loan. That person at the bank is actually not making a decision itself anymore. It just asks ChatGPT, which is a weird concept.
Yeah, I know.
But yeah, still, I mean, let's just...
I hope not, but I know.
If we just think of it like that. So it actually depends whether I get that loan or not, actually depends on how they feed the data into the system.
Yeah, basically, this is what we're saying here. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's some way of feeding it into the system like works better, which is not great. So like we hope that like some of these findings in this research would be that a lot of the like the model pre-training also has a lot more like serialization for the tables. It's mostly because like tables are structured data anyway, like you don't know how to represent them. And every other information that you use to pad those structured data is extra token that you have to account for in your context length. So if we're trying to go much more technical, you summarized it correctly.
All right. But that definitely relates to fairness, right? Because it can't really be all that fair if like serialization matters in terms of whether I get a loan or not, because it should be, I don't know, an informed decision on whether I'm financially stable or responsible enough, and not how this AI model thinks it should look like.
I mean, serialization is one angle in which unfairness could be introduced, right? Based on how the model was trained to begin with. But if you were being a responsible user of the technology, then it would be like some... you know a bit more about how this model is trained, and then you know how to format the text. Mm-hmm. But this is not realistic. So mm-hmm. We're talking about a loan officer.
Yeah.
That has a tool and it's just using it. And it's not like this model comes with manual to tell you that if you have a table, this is how you should serialize them. Because if you want to present it, then you're much more likely to get a reliable answer in this format or the other format. But now that we're talking about it, maybe we need to have some of those kind of manual for people to understand how to use these tools for different modality. So talking about the unfairness bit, I'm saying that if we even forget about the serialization, right? So just think about the model is expected to do what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
But it still can be unfair.
Yeah.
It still can encode the existing bias in the data.
Because as you've said, maybe the loan officer has already, I don't know, disadvantaged people.
Yeah, historically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like for some weird bias. And then you ask it. Actually, there's some research that that also just came out to say that given the same features and then just perturbing maybe some sensitive attribute like the gender mm-hmm. or something, like they found that the outcome, like the whether or not approved or denied, differs based on gender or things like that. So, but if they add additional instruction to the model to say something like, don't be unfair or don't use sensitive attribute or something like that, and then it's more often behave as expected. Okay. All of these are very stressful, and not stressful is not the right word. They're actually very scary.
Yeah.
This is the word. So this is also why we're cautioning against, you cannot just use the model as is for high stake decision making like that. Of course, like, you know, you can use it to understand more about, like, maybe collect data about the applicant, or like to receive more, summarize
that data.
Exactly. Yeah. But not to make the decision. Yeah. And it's just the tools are not there yet.
Yeah. But
for decision making.
What I was wondering is, like, you took those data sets and you serialized that and put them into LLMs, but is that as of now like an academical experiment, or is that something that you know that people at banks are already doing, or is it, do you have any data or idea on that?
No. So at the bank right now, I don't think they'll be using LLM to make that decision as is right now. But it's not because they cannot use it. It's a matter of how long before they decide to start using it. So things are changing very rapidly. These tools are getting more and more useful, powerful, also make them a little bit more dangerous. So I do think that in the next few years, it's possible that you might use it the way you just you explained the other day. It's just like, I'm a loan officer.
Yeah.
I have a candidate, because you've relied so much on this language model and they're doing very well for all these other tasks that has been integrated into your workflow. You just take the information that they give you and you ask LLM, based on this information, should I approve them a loan or not? You know, and then it says yes or no.
I mean,
I could see that happening. Yeah.
I mean, banks might not necessarily be using LLMs, but they could use their own AI models. Or
they could have their own in-house LLM, which is what a lot of the banks or like a lot of companies are actually investing a lot of money in, to have their own LLM that has access to their own data, you know, do so data protection and things like that.
Yeah.
You can just like feed customer data to proprietary model. So it is possible.
So the bias of that model would still apply, because then if you historically have given no loans to, or like like, let's say, lesser loans or with worse conditions to women, then that is a bias that will be perpetrated if they use their historical data to train their new model.
Yeah. I mean, so irrespective of this, the machine learning model that you're using, I think it's still extremely important to investigate what kind of features is being used by the model to make the decision. Mm-hmm. Like, you cannot just accept the answer as it is, and you know, you have to do a lot of try to augment, let's say you change the sensitive features, and then you try to say that, mm-hmm. but the output still remain the same, mm-hmm. and so on.
So you have to work and on the explainability of your own model.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think this is like very big in this iStake scenario.
Yeah.
They focus more on the explainability because they need to be able to explain the decision of the model.
But looking at your paper, what does fairness look like in that practice? Did you focus specifically on how fair the models are performing?
Yeah. So one of the big questions, like, for that particular work was also not just to see whether or not LLM can make this decision for iStake scenario, like Luna Prover, mm-hmm. but actually, does it make it in a fair way as well?
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that we investigated that question was to look at different fairness notions, mm-hmm. In literature. So one of the metrics was like statistical parity, that tries to look at, given a decision that a model make, if it makes it for a group that you care about, let's say a male, is it the same decision that is made for the female group? So statistical parity is trying to look at making sure that those are equal. And if it's not equal, then it's unfair.
Yeah.
And then there's also, we also looked at like equality of opportunity. So it's like when you look at the a group of people, a group like the sensitive group, again, say female, and the decision that the model makes for that group, is it based on the features, like other features that should be really affecting the loan approval, or is it just based on their gender?
Yeah.
So equality of opportunity, make sure that like you have equal opportunity, mm-hmm. for each group. So so those are the way in which we try to see if the models are also like, you know, unfair, mm-hmm. in that way. But it's not, our paper is not like a fairness paper, mm-hmm. right? We're asking different questions,
yeah.
about the LLM model, trying to see, is it fair in terms of the serialization, yeah. Path, or like, you know, but to actually look at the fairness is like within the decision. And then we look at the two different fairness notion, mm-hmm. to be able to quantify. And what we found is that it's not one result for all of the models and all of the data set, of course. But most of what we find out is that most of the models exhibit some form of unfairness with regards to the metric, mm-hmm. that we investigated. So, which says that like sometimes the model would give loan, would not give loan when it's supposed to give the loan to a particular group.
Yeah.
So our group of interest there was female.
Mm-hmm.
And so, this was okay. The investigation we did regarding fairness for the paper.
Okay. Going back to what you said on how LLMs might behave unfairly, you said that often that is like just repeating the biases of the data that has been trained on, as we've discussed in the beginning. So is it fair to say that like unfair AI is just mirroring the unfair real world?
I mean, yes. But we have to think about the algorithm itself. It's not unfair or fair.
Yeah.
mathematical construct. Like what it's learning is some statistical pattern in the data.
It doesn't have an intention.
Exactly. There's no intention. Like just to start from there.
Yeah.
So there's no way that it's going to be just fair by itself or something like that. But of course, like there's a lot of bias. There's a lot of ways in which bias can come into the process. And one of those biases is the data set bias, like we were talking about. But it's also, there's also like algorithmic bias, like how you fit in the parameters of the model can also introduce some bias. So it could lead to an algorithm that is unfair, you know? But I think a lot of the, focus usually is on the data set itself. Like the question is that if you have a data set that is not balanced in terms of the distribution that you want to study, can you, like, what can you expect from the model that you train on this data set? You can only expect to replicate whatever bias that is encoded in the data that you have, right? So so to your question, no, I don't think we can expect the models to be fair necessarily if you have a data set that is historically unfair or historically biased. But we can put in measures. You know, because we understand that we live in an imperfect world. We are not perfect. So we when we are developing these models, we put guardrails. It's like constraint learning. So you have instead of trying to be as accurate as you can based on your historical data. We sit back and say like, okay, we need to look at the different groups, what's the accuracy there? And then we can decide based on this like hundreds of fairness notion to see which ones do we want to balance or do we want to care for it. So it could be that in the sense of accuracy of the model without thinking about the fairness constraints might be a lot better. But it's a trade-off if we want to have a fair model, which is what I think we should always be trying to have.
So the idea is we're living in an imperfect world. That doesn't mean that AI can't do better.
Exactly. This is it. You said it. Because I see this argument about, if the world is unfair, can you even expect AI to be fair? I know where it's coming from, but I feel like it makes us lazy.
It's a sort of excuse.
It's like, there's nothing I can do about it. No, it's unacceptable, actually, in my worldview. So this is why there's a lot of research on privacy and there's a lot of research on fairness, because we know that there's a lot more we can do from that angle. It just means that we might need to suffer some, you know, accuracy in this other world. You know, it's just like this question about equality versus equity.
Versus maximal performance.
Exactly. So it's like, what do we want to be fair on? Or like who, what? So once we can decide all of that, we can, you know, we can choose to develop algorithms that are not exacerbating the unfairness in the society. You know, this is actually what makes AI very dangerous, actually, because if we're not intentional about how we want it to look like in the future, and we just like blindly feed in all of the data with all of this imperfection, it will just you know, exacerbate things. It's just the scale in which we can replicate this stereotype is larger.
It's
now
much larger.
So this is what is scary about this technology and why we really need to be intentional about how we build it. So what we're building for, who is excluded? If the data set is not balanced, What are we doing about it?
Yeah.
Are we just like, are we just releasing this model to the world? And it was like, we will fix it later. Let's gather data.
Yeah.
You know, like, are we being intentional when we want to release it? We've tested it so many times. We have a document that says these are all of the ways in which we've tested it. Of course, we're not perfect. We invite audience to even help us test it more in these ways. And then, you know, when we all have a consortium, we will all fire us like, okay, yeah, this model can be released for this purpose, you know, context specific, not just like the way we currently are just polluting the society, in my opinion, with so many models that are not well tested. Yeah. And this is why we have a lot of fake data. And I mean, I work in synthetic data generation, but I would say like my research is trying to stay close to the real data, but I don't want to digress from the conversation around fairness. But
no, I mean, there's a lot of very interesting topics that kind of go together. I think there's a lot of stuff we can't even isolate from each other because I think all of these things go together. But I think what I quite liked about a different paper of yours where you gathered recipes for
different world war
dishes. It was kind of exactly what I thought was a pretty good example for what happens when it's not balanced is when you tried to generate images of dishes that are like from, let's say, from the Western world, quite well known, like images of a hot dog
were
generated quite well, but images of,
Did you see that image? It looked like a real hot dog, right?
Yeah, but an image of an I don't know, African recipe that not many people know here was just gibberish.
Honestly, basically. Like if you looked at the appendix, the generation was extremely poor.
Yeah.
It was very disturbing, honestly. Like, and shout out to all of my collaborators and Siobhan, who brought us all together. She was the lead project coordinator. But so what we find also there is this gap that we know exists from a lot of different work, outstanding work out there. But we were able to show that when you have we collected data set from different region, our intention was to collect data set from all over the world.
Yeah.
We had a lot of data set from African Africans because like a lot of us are also Africans on the team. And so what we did was looking at the different ingredient that we collected, we prompted this LLM to generate visual language model to generate an image of food in say Nigeria or image of food named like Amala, which is a food from where I come from. And then it's not it gives you like this image that is like, it has nothing to, it's like, I cannot relate with it.
Yeah.
Or the worst case was actually a lot of these African foods are, when we asked annotator, community leaders to share with us the experience, and they were like, it looks very disgusting.
Yeah,
it's really bad.
Yeah.
Like sometimes it's like some clay or something, like not appealing at all compared to like some of the food item in the United States, which was our benchmark. So it just really shows that part of this problem comes from the fact that in our opinion, it's because there's not a lot of data out there that was used to train the model, which is like this unfairness, right? So when you start to, but these models are, they didn't say that we cannot use it in Africa because you don't even know how they train those models.
Yeah.
This is another problem that you have. You don't know how much data it injected, what data is missing, what region is missing. It's extremely important and it matters. So if we don't know that, you don't know how like how to not use it there in a particular region, because you just assume that they have covered many region of interest, which is usually not what is happening. So representation really matters.
But that's a good point, because you are actually working on representation.
Yeah, right? So
you're not just doing research, you're also like working to fix the upstream problem, I guess, because you're working on who gets represented, who gets access to AI skills, whose voices show up in the data sets.
Yeah.
Maybe tell us about what you're doing in all of your free time, because you have started this initiative called AI Saturdays Lagos, community where people in Lagos can learn AI and machine learning for free, share knowledge. So maybe tell us about it. What's your motivation behind that? How does it work?
Oh, gosh. Oh, thanks, Tobias. Okay, so yes, at the Lagos is a community that I co-founded back in 2018, actually. Mm-hmm. It's been so long, right? Yeah. Before I started my PhD or before I came to Germany. And there the motivation was to democratize the knowledge of AI. Mm-hmm. So at that time, I was also just starting to learn more about machine learning, and I wanted to find a community of like-minded, like myself, mm-hmm. where we come together to study and to learn. This is because it's not uncommon that in Nigerian you would study something in school and you would find out that you want to do something else. Mm-hmm. You want to transition. So in my case, we started with what I did from bachelor's, mm-hmm. studied mechanic engineering, but then I got interested in AI and machine learning, and so I didn't have this background in school, and so I needed to self-study, and so this is why I studied at Lagos. And it was, we started as a, every Saturday for 16 weeks, we would have machine learning related classes. Then we were looking at computer vision, CS231N from Stanford. So we often take the open source resources. And we just, after the first cohort, we just continued to teach, and the organizers got better and better over time because we were also learning, but now we became teachers of the community. And my passion for AI education, it's like generally I have am passionate about education in general. Mm-hmm. And so this is why I thought that from our initiative, we can provide a platform for people to learn. It could be people that want to transition or like they are currently studying, mm-hmm. To augment their knowledge, because a lot of this cutting edge materials are not currently embedded in mm-hmm. the curriculum.
Okay.
So you would have to self-study most of the time, look for extra material online. And we just wanted to be that hub, that community where you find the group of people that are also interested in topics, AI in general. And you can collaborate together, do research together, ask questions, learn, improve your skills. And what that does really is that we become a society of AI practitioners, AI researchers, scientists, and we can solve our own local problems, use mm-hmm. this cutting edge technology to tackle the problems that we have in our society. Okay. So, yeah.
And by that also solve some form of underrepresentation. Right?
Yeah, yes. I mean, underrepresentation in AI education, do you mean?
No, I mean, I guess what I was saying is that when you have a lot of people, let's say in the global south in general, that are now working on AI, these people will start to be represented in the AI work because they are the ones doing the work, right?
Yeah. For sure. Like, by democratizing AI knowledge, it gives everyone sit at the table.
Yeah.
And you're correct in saying that that's also underrepresentation. Actually, so who is building the technology matters so much. Mm-hmm. And because that's also where you find out that you get some perspective are left out. It's because they're not involved in the building of it. And a lot of the unfairness or like bias that has been reported also stem from maybe not thinking about the diversity that you have in the team that are building this global quote-unquote technology. So yeah, I'm not, you probably have heard about like some of this. This was like, what was it, 2021 or so, that when the Google app recognized black person as say gorilla. Did you hear about that?
No, I'm not sure I remember.
Yeah. So it was really in the news and everything. Okay. And what happened was that when they tested this app, they just didn't test it on black people at all. Okay. And also could be because most of the people that was helping or building that technology, you didn't have any diversity there, have black people had data set, and no one, what's worse is it's no one thought about it. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's this is a huge group of people and felt like no one thought about it. Yeah. And so, and to solve that, they removed the gorilla label from just to make sure that the app does not continue to do that prediction. Yeah. And just recently I tried to check search on the app to see search for gorilla.
Yeah.
And until now you still cannot search, it's kind of find gorilla because that word was just was banned. And this is many years ago. But I don't think even with the rollout they might have a lot more data now, but it feels like it's still not solved. I want to ask you, I had a question. I also wanted to know if you think AI can be fair or are they... What's your impression right now on this model?
Wow, my impression. I don't know. Sometimes I use, when I use ChatGPT and I ask it a question and it's so confidently wrong that that I get the idea of how can a system that is just dumb be fair, you know? You wouldn't expect from a dumb person that it would treat every decision in the world fairly. I mean, if a system is incorrect in many ways and it still confidently says that this is the right solution, of course it won't be fair. It just can't be. And I think as long as it's just an LLM that is being used for, I don't know, giving me travel plans and giving me ideas on how to fix my computer, things the stakes aren't that high. But as soon as I enroll a system, and of course it might not be an LLM in the end, but it might be, let's say, I don't know, an AI system that gives loan approvals or job approvals if I apply for a job. Those are stakes that I would expect the system to not dumb and be fair.
Better
and
know what they're doing, first of all.
And be fair. I mean, I'm not a computer scientist, so I don't really know on how well these systems will work in the near future. But I think it should give us some pause and to think about if that is
I think some of the challenge I see here is that, for the example, ChatGPT, back in 2022 when it just came out and we were using it, it was really bad on a lot of things. You would ask it to tell you about a person and it would hallucinate everything about them.
Yeah.
And but then it gets better and better on some of these failure modes that was reported online, and there's a lot of patches I can imagine from the developers to fix things and, and a lot of research is going on to it. You're finding jailbreaks and they're fixing it.
Yeah.
But I think the danger is the things in which you don't know very well that is wrong at right now, or even it's like you said, it's very confident.
Yeah.
And for some reason, humans can be very lazy as well. Yeah. And then you just take the output as it is. And I just think it's very dangerous when it's not even giving you the confidence. I mean, then usually when you say you train a machine learning model, the classical one, there will be confidence score.
Yeah.
Where maybe if it's like 0.6, but it still predicts the class that you want, but it's up to you to calibrate to see if you want to trust this decision or not, or like to just report all of the error and things like that. But with this chat model, you don't have a confidence score calibration. So it's just...
It just gives you back everything, 100%.
Everything.
That is truth.
And then, and then you're like, no, this is wrong. And it's like, oh, you're right. Yeah. This is wrong. Yeah. And, and it's continuous. Like, no, dude, this is really wrong. So, and there's so much potential that we... Like, so much application we want to use them for. I'm just not sure if the models are ready to be able to like take on any of this high stick. If we ever even should think of having such model, like first of all, like theoretically, I'm thinking, can you get to have an like such system be responsible for making decisions that historically, sometimes it's very subjective, you know. So what kind of features do you want it to use? I can imagine that maybe there will be processes that would help the loan approver officer to reach a conclusion that maybe the model could help with, like summarizing documentation or like text or like doing like deep research to the limit, to the extent to which it can do it and things like that. And assuming that there are like guardrails in place to make sure that if it's not sure or confident about the answer to something, it does not have to answer, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
I don't
just,
know.
You don't have to answer.
But I don't know is an answer.
I don't know. I don't know. Like ask in a different way or like I can help with X, Y, Z, you know? But I guess it does not make it too exciting from the developers, like in terms of like how many people use it and how much money maybe they can make. They want to have a general purpose tool, which there's a question about how useful it is to like the society. I feel like it's really important to get the truth level of that of those tools to where it needs to be. It's not okay for hallucinating and things like that, but a lot of researchers are working on it, but still there's a lot to do in that area.
Okay, so now with all this talk on how AI can be in the future or should be in the future, I mean, we want to end on a positive note. What keeps you hopeful when you think about the future of AI?
It's the potential of how it can be used for social good.
Okay.
That's really what keeps me very hopeful. This, so coming back to why I even got into AI to begin with, which is thinking about like how to build an intelligent machines which can help with
cleaning
task,
your room.
With task, you know, both mundane and non-mundane. So think about the applications of AI now for agriculture, for grid, electricity, you know, to help us discover better drug, you know, cure diseases and things like that. It's just the possibility feels endless right now. This is also why I'm very passionate about ensuring that this AI models or systems are built in an ethical way, because I feel like it's extremely important that we have those ethical framework in place as we build these applications and explore the potential of the AI systems for hopefully a better future.
So we have a great chance. We just have to play it right.
I think so.
Yeah.
With great power comes great responsibility.
I quoted Spider-Man as well in one of the episodes. That is, I think it always comes back to that, especially when it's about AI.
But the thing is that I think we can do it if we just work together and we think about, we think more about this social good use case and less about maybe our own greed and fight for power.
Yeah.
You know, like I am optimistic. I'm an optimist. The reason why I want to democratize AI knowledge in Africa is also because I know that this technology is here to stay. It's exciting, if we want to put it that way. Yeah. And it's useful for a lot of scenarios. We just really need to be able to have the right people in charge.
Yeah.
So it does not become a weapon for exacerbating existing inequality in the society or things like that. So if you're not part of the design of that technology, you easily can be overlooked. Yeah, again. potential.
Yeah, you're very passionate about the topic and I think it should be exactly like that. So perfect. For the end, you will also get 5 quick questions, all our guests will get. So first one, what part of AI research still excites you the most?
I'd say the possibility of applying this research to solving local problem. I'm excited about that for the future because I want to explore it a lot for African problems. So,
okay. What do you think is the most common misconception people have about AI?
I think some people think it can do everything. Like, it's good equally for all context. But as a lot of research has shown, mine included, it breaks down depending on where it's been applied. So underserved communities are not currently enjoying the same benefit of AI. Maybe in their local language, it's not very accurate or accurate at all. And so on. I can go on and on. Yeah. You said rapid questions.
Perfect. So what is one AI or research buzzword you would happily retire forever?
Okay. The research buzzword for sure for me is novel.
so like a novel solution.
Yeah.
So, okay.
I think can be quite overused, like in a lot of research papers, such that even if you prompt like ChatGPT or anything for this, like novel,
it's
like,
in well, there everywhere.
Yeah, what is novel? Okay. So I happily retire novel.
Okay. So researchers do have and overestimate what novel means.
Yeah. And right now it's not very meaningful, I would say, in my opinion.
Okay. So engineering or AI, which one did you enjoy more?
Right now, I think I'm enjoying both equally. I was very good student of mechanical engineering, and I loved it. But it was a different life. I was a student. I never really worked as a mechanical engineer besides some internship where I was fixing cars and everything. And I love that. I could see myself building, fixing cars and things like that. But I also love AI right now. I love the potential, machine learning. And so I would say at the moment, equally, but I definitely struggled a bit, like transitioning to computer science. So maybe that was a little bit challenging and I'm still warming up. I'm not there yet. But in the future, I'll probably become professor in machine learning and some things. Who knows?
I will look forward to your lectures.
I know. I look forward to my lectures.
Okay, then. Last question. So one sentence of advice for future engineers or AI researchers, what would you give them on the way?
Just keep trying. So that's my general advice for life. It's just that, what can you do except try? Just keep trying. But future AI researcher, learn the fundamentals. There's a lot of buzzwords now and things like that. And it just keeps changing.
Yeah.
But you know what never changes, rarely changes? Fundamentals.
Okay. The math behind it.
Once you know that, you can shape and, you know, come up with new theory, come up with new things. Like, and the fundamentals are usually small, but extremely important part. And then once you have it, you can put the pieces the way you want it. So fundamentals, learn the fundamentals.
Awesome.
Please.
I think that is good advice for every kind of field you're going into.
Yes.
Awesome. Thanks, Teju. I really enjoyed this. Thank you very much for giving us your perspective on fairness and AI and teaching me a few things on how these things work.
Thank you so much for having me.
See you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that wraps up this episode of TISPA TLDR. Thanks again to Teju for joining this episode. If you'd like to explore more of her work, check out the links in the show notes. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And maybe leave us a rating or review. It helps others discover this show. I'm Tobias Ebelzhäuser. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with more stories from the world of cybersecurity and AI made simple. Until then, take care.